Hello, welcome to the podcast. In this week's parasha, Parasha Pekudei, and for the last week's parasha as well, Parasha Vayakhel, we've been dealing with the implementation of the building of the Mishkan. So, as we know, Moshe was commanded to, with very detailed instructions about how to build the Mishkan, and these were dealt with in Parasha Truma and Tetzaveh, and in the last couple of parashas was the actual implementation described about how Bezalel, Ohaliav, and their team of artisans actually created things. Now, as is commonly known, one of the issues with these parashas is that the Torah repeats the same degree of detail in manner of construction as was originally described in the original commands given by Hashem to Moshe. And everyone asked the question, why the need for the repetition? It's very blatant. And then again, after each section, when it says the description of what was done, and it ends, Kasher tziva Hashem et Moshe, that they did as Hashem commanded Moshe. Well, if they did as Hashem commanded Moshe, then why tell me the detail? And if you're going to tell me the details, then I know it was Kasher tziva Hashem et Moshe. Here you have this seeming redundancy. So that's a major question. Now, in terms of answering this question, we will see that it actually, I believe, relates to a very fundamental concept in Judaism as a whole. And how does this work? So the Midrash describes, in reconciling the two accounts, it points out that there's actually a difference in the order of the things that Hashem told Moshe, and the order in which the artisans and led by Bezalel actually carried out the building. So one of the notable distinctions is that when Hashem commanded Moshe in Parashat Teruma to construct the Mishkan, the first items that were mentioned were the Aron, the Shulchan, the Menorah, the Kelim, the vessels of the Mishkan, and only afterwards did the Torah describe the Yiriyot, the curtains that made up the structure, the physical structure, the krashim, the beams, the sockets, the adanim, and the actual physical outer structure of the Mishkan. So that's the order that follows in Parashat Terumah, whereas in our parashas, Vayakhel and Pekudei, or Vayakhel really, it describes how first the Bezalel built the outer structure. First he built the Mishkan and its coverings and the various layers of covering and then the courtyard that surrounded it, and only afterwards does it describe him building the Kelim, the various vessels, the Aron, the Shulchan and the Menorah, etc. So the Midrash describes that Moshe actually quizzes him about this fact and says to him, one second, Hashem told me this way, he told me first the vessels and afterwards the structure. So, to which Bezalel responds and says, but that's not logical. You can't build the vessels of a house before you build the house. Where are you going to put them? Now, I think this Midrash actually highlights the fundamental idea behind each of these sets of parashas, Terumah Tetzaveh on the one hand, and Vayakhel Pekudei on the other. Because Parasha Terumah Tetzaveh describes the heavenly focus, the heavenly perspective on what the Mishkan is about. In other words, what is the most important thing from Hashem's perspective? What's most important about the Mishkan? Is it the physical structure of the Mishkan, or is it the vessels within? It's the vessels within, because the vessels, the Aron that contains the Luchot, that is going to be the vessel upon which God's presence will rest, and from it's between the Kruvim that Hashem's voice would emanate to speak to the Jewish people. The Mishkan itself, yes, it was necessary to have such a structure, but the primary components were the vessels that actually bring the tachlis, the main goal of the Mishkan, that is the presence of the Shekhinah. So this is what the heavenly perspective is. It's about purpose, it's about meaning, the meaning of the Mishkan. In contrast to that, Vayakhel Pekudei emphasizes the human component, the human perspective of the Mishkan, of constructing the Mishkan. So from a human perspective, from an earthly perspective, practically you have to build the structure first before you can put in the kelim, so you have somewhere to put the vessels. It doesn't make sense to do otherwise. An earthly perspective gets involved in the pragmatic, the practical component of what needs to be done. That's one aspect of the earthly perspective. Another aspect, else do you see this concept of the earthly perspective involved in the construction of the Mishkan? The Torah emphasizes over and over in Parashat Vayakhel the concept of nedivut lev, of generosity of heart, that the people who contribute towards the items, the materials needed for the Mishkan, need to do so from a state of nedivut lev, generosity of spirit. Not only that, but the people, the artisans who construct it, it talks about nisa'o libo, that their heart has to inspire them to be involved. In other words, the Torah is going out of its way, and these terms are used multiple times in Parashat Vayakhel. The Torah is emphasizing the fact that the human component has to be seen in the Mishkan. It's not about following instructions, it's about you being passionate about building the Mishkan. Why is passion so important? Because it's the passion. The Mishkan is not just a structure that serves a goal. The Mishkan is a home for Hashem and the Jewish people, and therefore in order for Hashem to put his heart into it, to put his Shechina into it, to put his presence into it, he needs the Jewish people to put their heart into it. That Hashem's involvement will be proportional to the extent of Am Yisrael's commitment. In other words, it's not just the physical materials that the Jews had to contribute, they had to contribute their hearts as well. Now, the fact that the Torah emphasizes the heavenly perspective and the earthly perspective, I believe, is a fundamental principle in Judaism, which is that the Torah is about harmonizing the spiritual, the heavenly, with the physical and the earthly. In contrast to other belief systems, which focus either on the heavenly and spiritual, and in a sense downplay the importance of the physical, Judaism says that it's not about spiritual, it's not about physical, it's about the harmonization of the two. And it's in this process of construction that we see both elements coming and meeting, the meeting of heaven and earth. That the people did it from a human earthly perspective, and yet it was kasher tziva Hashem et Moshe, just like Hashem commanded. Now, why do I say that this is so fundamental? Well, we see these examples of this concept in numerous places in the Torah. I'll give a couple of examples. One area is in the Jewish calendar. So it's commonly said that the secular calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is a solar calendar, whereas the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. That's how people often present it. But that's not actually true, because the Jewish calendar is both solar and lunar. Yes, it is lunar, its months are based on the moon, but it's solar because the process of the leap years ensure that the calendar will keep up with the solar year. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, the sun represents the concept of the fixed nature of the heavens. The heavens operate in an orderly, predictable, fixed fashion. And from Earth's perspective, the sun is the most dominant feature of all of them, of all the heavenly bodies. In contrast to that, the moon represents something which is almost terrestrial, meaning it is a heavenly body, although it's a heavenly body that revolves around the Earth. And the nature of its illumination, the way it waxes and wanes, represents something which is less than perfect. It is more like the imperfections of our world, where sometimes, in fact, Chazal utilized the moon as a symbol of the concept of the Shekhinah, of Hashem's presence, that sometimes Hashem's presence is more manifest, other times Hashem's presence is more concealed, just like the moon's light is more manifest at times and more concealed at others. That is the nature of the moon, and that is the nature of our world. So to have a calendar which synchronizes, not exactly synchronizes, but create some sort of arrangement which harmonizes the sun and the moon's paths is a reflection of this concept that the Torah seeks to harmonize the heavenly with the earthly, the perfect rhythmic heavenly behavior with the sometimes unpredictable and erratic earthly reality. In the Kabbalah, they talk about the heavenly realm, the ideal perspective of reality as expressed by the concept of Tiferet, of splendor, whereas our world is related to the sphere of Malchut, and that Malchut is something which eventually, in the time of Mashiach, will reach its peak and will become perfected. But in the meantime, it is awaiting perfection. And I want to give you also another example of this merging between heavenly and earthly. If we look in Parshat Kedoshim, Sefer Vayikra, Perek Kaf, so here you have a description of a chapter which deals with all kinds of abominable practices. Some of them are related to idolatry, many of them are related to sexual immorality, and here the Torah tells you the death penalties that are associated by them. Pasuk after pasuk, it describes motumatu, that they shall surely die, and these patterns are just repeated over and over again. It's a very death-filled chapter. And a person listening to this would think that, you know, imagining Jewish life in biblical times must have been a bit like the French Revolution, people being killed left, right and center. It would have been blood flowing through the streets. And yet when you go to the Mishnah, so the oral tradition, the end of the Mishnah Perek, first Perek of Makot, the Mishnah tells us, it's a famous quote, Sanhedrin ha'oreged echad b'shavua, Sanhedrin that kills a person, has a person put to death once every sabbatical year, once sabbatical cycle, nikret chavlanit, is considered destructive. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah gives his own opinion. He thinks it's considered destructive if they have someone put to death once every 70 years. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva go on to say, if we were in the Sanhedrin, no person would ever be killed. How would they do that? So they said they would cross-examine the witnesses. You have to have two witnesses whose evidence tallies up completely with each other, and they would have cross-examined the witnesses until they found some inconsistency, and they would be able to dismiss any case. Ramon Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, he disagrees. He says, no, that by if you do that, then everyone's going to get off, and then you'll have a lot of, you'll have shofchei damim, you'll have lots of murderers running around in the Jewish people. Now, what's going on with this debate? If the Torah tells you that a person is liable to the death penalty, how can the Torah Shebal Peh, how can the Oral Torah come along and tell you how often that they should be putting people to death? Justice is justice. Either they deserve to die or they don't deserve to die. You can't say, how can you put a label on a Beit Din that has someone put to death more than once every 7 years as being destructive? How can Rabbi Yitzhak and Rabbi Akiva come along and say that they would have people, everybody let off? You know, that's a miscarriage of justice. But it seems that the idea is here, and this is an idea that I saw quoted in the name of Rav Kook, that the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, in a sense, is supposed to be the, we'll call it the voice of the Father. It's supposed to be the voice of strict discipline. Meaning when you want something, if you want somebody to know how serious a particular action is, you threaten to punish them with a very severe threat, as a deterrent, in order they should know that it's serious. So you say, if you touch someone else, so-and-so's wife, I'm going to kill you. Now, does that mean the Torah is really interested in having people killed? That's not what the Torahs were interested in at all. The Torah is interested in life. However, it's a deterrent in order to ensure that people take it seriously. They realize that someone who does something like this really deserves to die, although that's not what the Torah wants from them. So the Torah Shebal Peh, the practical system of how you implement it, takes that into account and creates a system where, which Rav Kook calls it, the voice of the mother, meaning it's looking out for the with compassion upon the person. God doesn't want people to die as a result of these sins. The whole thing is to avoid such an outcome. But sometimes you have to be strict and set hard boundaries in order that people will stay in line and it will be good for them in the long term. Therefore, on the one hand, the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, writes things in such a way that if you do these things, you're going to die. But in practice, it never happened, because the Torah Shebal Peh created so many obstacles to prevent the actual death penalty from being carried out that it would ensure that we don't become a bloodthirsty society, and that the halakha not become a bloodthirsty system. That's why Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon said that they would cross-examine people to the extent that it would not be possible to put anyone to death, because that's really what the Torah is driving at. Comes along Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and says, but one second, you've gone too far. Because if you never put anybody to death, then the Torah's laws lose their deterrent effect. They're not going to deter anybody, because they know they can get away with murder. They can get away with anything. And therefore, according to him, it has to happen sometimes. It just mustn't happen too often. It mustn't happen more than once every 7 years or once every 70 years. And that way people will think and say, well, I remember so-and-so got killed for that. And then it maintains a seriousness in their minds. But that's not what the Torah... Now, in terms of what we've been saying here, this is the balance between, I would suggest, the ideal heavenly realm where nobody ever acts out of line. You create a system which does not allow, has zero tolerance for any of these things. And if you do it, you die. That's the perfect heavenly perspective. But in real life on earth, that's not what we want to happen. We don't want such a situation. Yes, people go out of the line. People cross the boundaries they shouldn't cross. We don't want to kill somebody, everybody, every time we do that. Because at the end of the day, we want people to live. The Torah is a system of life, not of death. And therefore we have the oral Torah, which looks from the practical perspective of what the Torah is trying to implement in this world. And here again I am suggesting this is the concept of the balance between the heavenly perspective to act as a deterrent and set high standards, to set ideals, and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the earthly Torah, which tells you practically how to implement things in this world. And really this is the challenge of what it is, what it means to live a Torah life, is implementing heavenly ideals in a real practical world. It's not about running away from the world, it's about taking our world and sanctifying it and elevating it. But in the meantime, before it's elevated, it's an imperfect world, and that's a tremendous challenge. How to create a system, and this is what the Torah is intended to be, a system which can bridge the gap between the heavenly realm and the earthly realm. Thank you everyone for joining me, and wishing you a good week and a Shabbat Shalom.